The Beatles are an extraordinary act in England. I think they're the biggest thing in England in 25 years. And actually, the music is rock and roll. Now, we've never, in my 7 years at NBC, ever on The Tonight Show, on this show, ever had a rock and roll act. But I'm interested in the Beatles as a psychological, sociological phenomenon. And I want to show them to you tonight. They're from the toughest part of England. It's Merseyside, on near Liverpool, in the dock area. And it's a very tough area where these four nice kids come from. They're kind of witty. Someone said, what's so exciting about living on the docks at Liverpool? He says, just staying alive is exciting in the docks. but they're nice kids, and I'd like to show you now all for the first time what it looks like in an audience in England when the Beatles are about to perform. I understand science is working on a cure for this. These guys have these crazy hairdos, and when they wiggle their head and the hair goes, the girls go out of their mind. Does it bother you to realize that in a few years these girls will both raise children and drive cars? I just show you this in case you're going to England and want to have a fun evening. It's nice to know that England has finally risen to our cultural level. Ed Sullivan's going to have the Beatles on live in February, and our interest was just showing a more adult audience that usually follows my work, what's going on in England.
Deal with the uncertainty you're talking about, but yeah, no question about it. It's a difficult period. Yeah, Kim.
Thank you, sir. Now that you've found a location for your presidential library, you've got to find the money to build it. Reports indicate that you may be trying to collect as much as $200 million. Is that figure accurate? Do you believe it's important for the American people to know who is giving that kind of money to their president? Will you disclose the contributions as they come in? And will you place any restriction on who gives money and how much they can give?
No, yes, no, yes. First question. I haven't... Man, you obviously haven't asked a question in a long time. It's like, you know, I haven't seen the final budget. Two, as Donnie Evans said, who's the chairman of the foundation, we'll look at the disclosure requirements and make a decision. Here's the, there's a lot of people, or some people, I shouldn't say a lot, some people who like to give and don't particularly want their names disclosed, whether it be for this foundation or any other foundation. And so we'll take that into consideration. Thirdly, what was the other?
Any restrictions on who can give? Will you take foreign money for this?
Yeah, probably take some foreign money, but don't know yet, Ken. We just announced the deal, and I frankly have been focused elsewhere, like on gasoline prices and, you know, my trip to Africa, and haven't seen the fundraising strategy yet. And so the answer to your question, really, I can't answer your question.
Where does people's right to know this fit into all of that?
We're weighing, taking a look, taking consideration, giving up serious consideration. Nice try, though. Olivia.
I don't have anything to announce for you today as to what those things might be, but I will tell you that we continue to look at it and try to figure out the best ways that we can help America as a whole, not just lenders and not just borrowers, but everybody, since we have a shared interest in making sure we can mitigate against this problem.
Does the president realize he's going to further tarnish our image for humanity if he vetoes a ban on torture?
That's not what he's suggesting, Helen. You're talking about the Senate the intelligence authorization bill?
Isn't he supposed to veto the ban this week or so?
Helen, he is going to veto a bill, but it's not the bill in which you describe. The bill that he's going to veto is the intelligence authorization bill. We've had a statement of administration position that has been out for a long time. There are many different reasons he's going to veto it. One of the main ones is that it would apply the Army Field Manual, which is very good guidance for young soldiers who are out on the field who might capture somebody out on the battlefield. But it is not something that should apply to a terrorist interrogation program that is run
Why?
By the CIA.
It's torture, isn't it?
It isn't. No, we are not torturing. That is not what the bill says.
Well, it would ban. If he is
torture is already illegal.
Ban on torture. torture.
Torture is already illegal in this country, and the president has already signed a bill reiterating that fact. The simple point of this bill is that the Army Field Manual, the president does not believe, nor does the intelligence community. I point you to General Hayden and others who say this should, that it should not. It is appropriate for the military to have the Army Field Manual as its guidelines. But we do not believe that it should apply to the Central Intelligence Agency.
Why? Are they human beings? Are we humane people?
We are humane people. We have a terrorist interrogation program that helps make sure that we keep this country safe. We do not torture. But what I will tell you is that you will hear more about this this weekend. The president's radio address will be on this issue.
And now, a message from the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
Good morning. This week I addressed the Department of Homeland Security on its fifth anniversary and thanked the men and women who work tirelessly to keep us safe. Because of their hard work and the efforts of many across all levels of government, we have not suffered another attack on our soil since September the 11th, 2001. This is not for a lack of effort on the part of the enemy. Al-Qaeda remains determined to attack America again. 2 years ago, Osama bin Laden warned the American people, quote, operations are under preparation, and you will see them on your own ground once they are finished, end quote. Because the danger remains, we need to ensure our intelligence officials have all the tools they need to stop the terrorists. Unfortunately, Congress recently sent me an intelligence authorization bill that would diminish these vital tools. So today, I vetoed it, and here's why. The bill Congress sent me would take away one of the most valuable tools in the war on terror, the CIA program to detain and question key terrorist leaders and operatives. This program has produced critical intelligence that has helped us prevent a number of attacks. The program helped us stop a plot to strike a U.S. Marine camp in Djibouti, a planned attack on the U.S. consulate in Karachi, a plot to hijack a passenger plane and fly it into Library Tower in Los Angeles, and a plot to crash passenger planes into Heathrow Airport or buildings in downtown London. And it has helped us understand Al-Qaeda's structure and financing and communications and logistics. Were it not for this program, our intelligence community believes that Al-Qaeda and its allies would have succeeded in launching another attack against the American homeland. The main reason this program has been effective is that it allows the CIA to use specialized interrogation procedures to question a small number of the most dangerous terrorists under careful supervision. The bill Congress sent me would deprive the CIA of the authority to use these safe and lawful techniques. Instead, it would restrict the CIA's range of acceptable interrogation methods to those provided in the Army Field Manual. The procedures in this manual were designed for use by soldiers questioning lawful combatants captured on the battlefield. They were not intended for intelligence professionals trained to question hardened terrorists. Limiting the CIA's interrogation methods to those in the Army Field Manual would be dangerous because the manual is publicly available and easily accessible on the Internet. Shortly after 9/11, we learned that key Al-Qaeda operatives had been trained to resist the methods outlined in the manual. And this is why we created alternative procedures to question the most dangerous Al-Qaeda operatives, particularly those who might have knowledge of attacks planned on our homeland. The best source of information about terrorist attacks is the terrorists themselves. If we were to shut down this program and restrict the CIA to methods in the field manual, we could lose vital information from senior Al-Qaeda terrorists, and that could cost American lives. The bill Congress sent me would not simply ban one particular interrogation method, as some have implied. Instead, it would eliminate all the alternative procedures we've developed.
It's me, Snuggly, the security bear. We love you and we'll listen to you. President Bush will listen to you and loves you so much, he broke the law and began spying on America. That's not illegal, that's love. Some telecom companies will break multiple laws to help the government spy on you because they love America and freedom so much. Unless the government stops paying them to spy, then they'll disconnect spy service. After all, freedom isn't free.
The warrantless wiretap you called has been disconnected or is no longer in service. Please pay your bill and try again.
Congress loves you so much, they'll enshrine an illegal spying program into legal law because they want you snugly and secure. Some will even go back in time and give amnesty to lawbreakers, because if we did punish lawbreakers, they might not help us next time we have to break the law. We love you and want to protect you from terrorists who want to undermine our system of laws and democracy. So we have to undermine our system of laws and democracy to protect you from terrorists. The spies who love you and want you snugly and secure. And if you don't believe me, you're supporting terrorism.
Those kinds of statements from a couple of people in the administration, maybe Senator Biden, maybe on the Democrat side, statements like that. Is he interested in going back and running for president or anything like that? Okay. In that sense, yeah, I understand what he wants. He wants basically vindication from the United States. He wants the U.S. to basically say he wasn't president and the people were misled. The exact budget I'll come up with, but it'll be somewhere between 600,000 and 750, with about a third of it going directly to the Bush Library.
And the image will be like this.
Yes.
On another subject, is the White House disappointed that this lobbyist, Stephen Payne, is on a videotape suggesting that he can deliver high-level White House meetings, including with the Vice President, in exchange for big contributions to the Bush Library?
I'd say there's categorically no link between any official business and the Bush Library. Steve Payne was never an employee of the White House, but we do use hundreds of volunteers a year, as you know, for helping us do advance work. And of course, you know, I don't know all of the facts about that situation, but we certainly would not advocate for such behavior.
How close is he to the president, and has he ever brought any of his clients to the White House for meetings?
That I don't know. I do know that he's been a Republican fundraiser for many years, so I believe the president has probably met him on a number of occasions, but he was never an employee of the White House, and so I don't know particularly about any contacts that they would have had or at the White House. But.
And last thing, just to clear it up then, mm-hmm. would the White House be willing to release any visitor logs to show whether or not he was here with clients? Because he's out
I'd
there
I'd have to check with the counsel's office. I mean, obviously, we've been down this road before with visitor logs, and there's lawsuits and things, so I'll have to check where that sits with visitor's
Same
office.
Subject, please. Mm-hmm. Are there any written guidelines? Is there any kind of an official firewall between the administration and the library?
I can check for you. I mean, I believe so, in terms of just practice of how we've been working here, but I'll have to check in terms of if there's anything written or that it needed to be written. There's obviously many people who are working on the library, but I don't know of anybody at the White House who has any dealings with it. Any particular dealings with the library or the development of the library or the foundation. I don't know of anybody here at the White House.
There's no liaison at all?
Possibly, I think, obviously, because you have to do scheduling with the president and talk to the president. But I don't know of anybody in particular whose assignment it is to work on library issues in particular.
Said, no, you're wrong. When I was a boy, everything was understand what I said. I said, no, 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 you're wrong. When I was a boy, everything was right. Everything was right. I said, even though you know what you know,
we begin tonight with a shakeup in the Obama campaign and the word that caused all that trouble, monster. Moments ago, I spoke with the reporter who did that interview from the Scotsman, Gary Pev. Gary Pev, thanks for joining us. I wonder if you'll give us some context for the phrase that wound up ending Samantha Power's relationship with the Obama campaign. Here's the quote. You're familiar with it, of course. She is a monster, too. That is off the record. She is stooping to anything. What was she talking about exactly? It's not precisely clear from the quote.
Hi there. Samantha Power just come back from having a phone conversation with one of her other advisors about, allegedly about something he'd said about NAFTA. And she was talking about, I'd asked her, well, you know, what's wrong? She said, oh, we screwed up in the campaign today in Ohio. And I said, why? What happened? She didn't use that same word, by the way, but yeah. I understand I can't swear on air. And I said, why? What happened? And she just basically said that her friend had made some off-the-record comments, and that, and I said, well, will anyone really be that worried about what he said? And she said, in Ohio, they're obsessed. Yeah, that's the state, the only state that Hillary thinks she can win, and, you know, they're obsessed, and she's a monster. That's off the record. And she was referring to that particular quote about Hillary allegedly being a monster as being off the record.
Right. Well, she wanted it off the record. Typically, the arrangement is if someone you're interviewing wants a quote off the record, you give it to them off the record. Why didn't you do that?
Are you really that acquiescent in the United States? In the United Kingdom, journalists believe that on or off the record is a principle that's decided ahead of the interview. If a figure in public life,
right.
Someone who is ostensibly going to be an advisor to the man who could be the most powerful politician in the world, if she makes a comment and decides it's a bit too controversial and wants to withdraw it immediately after, unfortunately, if the interview's on the record, it has to go ahead.
Right.
I didn't
Well, it's a little... Right, but I mean, since journalistic standards in Great Britain are so much dramatically lower than they are here, it's a little much being lectured on journalistic ethics by a reporter from The Scotsman, but I wonder if you could just explain what you think the effect is on the relationship between the press and the powerful. People don't talk to you when you go out of your way to hurt them as you did in this piece. Don't you think that hurts the rest of us in our effort to get to the truth from the principals in these campaigns?
If this is the first time that candid remarks have been published about what one campaign team thinks of the other candidate, then I would argue that your journalists aren't doing a very good job of getting to the truth. Now, I did not go out of my way in any way, shape, or form to hurt Ms. Power. I believe she's an intelligent and perfectly affable woman. In fact, she is incredibly intelligent, so she may have known what she was doing. She regretted it. She probably acted with integrity. It's not for me to decide one way or the other whether she did the right thing. But I did not go out to try and end her career. In the United Kingdom, when people make off-the-cuff remarks and they get published if they're politicians, quite often after a few weeks or months when the fuss dies down, they're rehabilitated, they're given posts. So.
Right. Then I wonder if you're justifying printing something she wanted off the record, I wonder why you didn't make the effort to determine what she was talking about. When she said Hillary is a monster, it's still not clear to me what she's talking about. Did you ask a follow-up question to determine that?
I didn't ask her too much more about she's a monster. I sort of discussed whether or not she thought people around her campaign team liked her, and I said to her, well, over here in the press, she's come across in some of the broadcasts as looking a little bit desperate, and Ms. Power agreed, and she said she's coming across as desperate here, i.e. the United Kingdom. We hope she's coming across as desperate there as well. It's not really my job to self-censor an interview. What I was trying to do was underscore the tensions in the campaign.
It's not your job to determine.
Is it your job? Do you censor interviews?
Well, when I interview people, I attempt to understand what they're talking about. That's part of what it is to interview someone, not simply to get someone using vulgarity on the record, but to understand what they're saying. That's part of the journalism process in the United States.
The interview was on the record, by the way. Someone made a controversial comment, decided to withdraw it.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate it. Gary Pabst, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone in the White House and it's ringing. Something's happening in the world. Your vote will decide who answers that call. Whether it's someone who already knows the world's leaders, knows the military, someone tested and ready to lead in a dangerous world. It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. Who do you want answering the phone?
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
Hey, it's John Dickerson from Slate. What foreign policy moment would you point us to in Hillary's career where she's been tested by crisis?
Well, you know, I think that, as she says, she has been tested, you know, throughout her life in so many matters. I think that she, again, has the experience and the strength that people see through her work on the Armed Services Committee and her work on extensively the military matters. I think it was a moment of test when she was in China and she stood up and said women's rights or human rights, that she showed the kind of wisdom that it takes to know when to push basic elements of basic elements under difficult circumstances.
Here come old flat top, he come grooving up slowly. He got juju up all he want, holy roller. He got hands down to his knee. Got to be a joker, he just do what he please.
On behalf of all of the State Fair Board and all the good guys from WIMP, may I present the Beatles!
He wears no shoeshine, he got touch and football, he got monkey finger, he shoot Coca-Cola, he said, I know you know me. One thing I can tell you is you got to be free. Come together.
The Democratic nominee for the president.
You guys are not supposed to be here.
Okay, we got about 60 seconds of privacy before they find out we're here now. So, what's on your mind, Senator?
I don't know.
Okay, I gotta get out of here. See, I told you they'd be
here. Marvin, what do we do now?
Wait a minute, what?
And that's all I have from that day. I don't even know if the fan arrived later, and I have no clear memory of how we spent the rest of the afternoon and evening. I remember Louise singing a song, her husband leaning back in his chair, folding his hands behind his head, expressing his pleasure in his young wife's voice. I remember that I felt quite extraordinarily content just then, and that's all I remember. But there are, of course, the things we both know. We know they moved to Colorado to be near Charles's parents. We know they never had any children. We know that Charles fell down a shaft at a construction site in the fall of 1957 and was hurt so badly that he never walked again. And I know that when she came to stay with us last summer, she told me she'd learned to hate him, and not for what she'd had to help him do all those years. No, it started earlier and was deeper than that. She hadn't minded the care of him, the washing and feeding and all the numberless small tasks she had to perform each and every day, all day. She hadn't minded this. In fact, she thought there was something in her makeup that liked being needed so completely. The trouble was simply that whatever she had once loved in him, she had stopped loving, and for many, many years before he died, she'd felt only suffocation when he was near enough to touch her, only irritation and anxiety when he spoke. She said all this and then looked at me, her cousin, who had been fortunate enough to have children and to be in love over time, and said, "John, how have you and Marie managed it?" And what I wanted to tell you has to do with this fact, that while you and I had had one of our whispering arguments only moments before I felt quite certain of the simple truth of the matter, which is that whatever our complications, we have managed to be in love over time. Louise, I said. People start out with such high hopes, she said, as if I wasn't there. She looked at me. Don't they? Yes, I said. She seemed to consider this a moment. Then she said, I wonder how it happens. I said, you ought to get some rest, or something equally pointless and admonitory. As she moved away from me, I had an image of Charles standing on the station platform in Charlottesville that summer, the straw boater set at its cocky angle. It was an image I would see most of the rest of that night, and on many another night since. I can almost hear your voice as you point out that once again I've managed to dwell too long on the memory of something that's past and gone. The difference is that I'm not grieving over the past now. I'm merely reporting a memory so that you might understand what I'm about to say to you. The fact is, we aren't the people we were even then, just a year ago. I know that. As I know, things have been slowly eroding between us for a very long time. We are a little tired of each other, and there are annoyances and old scars that won't be obliterated with a letter, even a long one written in the middle of the night in desperate sincerity, under the influence, admittedly, of a considerable portion of bourbon whiskey, but nevertheless with the best intention and hope. That you may know how, over the course of this night, I came to the end of needing an explanation for our difficulty. We have reached this place. Everything we say seems rather aggravatingly mindless and automatic, like something one stranger might say to another in one of the thousand circumstances where strangers are thrown together for a time, and the silence begins to grow heavy on their minds, and someone has to say something. Darling, we go so long these days without having anything at all to do with each other, and the children are arriving tomorrow, and once more we'll be in the position of making all the gestures that give them back their parents as they think their parents are. And what I wanted to say to you, what came to me as I thought about Louise and Charles on that day so long ago when they were young and so obviously glad of each other, and I looked at them and knew it and was happy. What came to me was that even the harsh things that happened to them, even the years of anger and silence, even the disappointment and the bitterness and the wanting not to be in the same room anymore, even all that must have been worth it for such loveliness. At least I am here at 70 years old hoping so. Tonight, I went back to our room again and stood gazing at you asleep, dreaming whatever you were dreaming. And I had a moment of thinking how we were always friends, too. Because what I wanted finally to say was that I remember well our own sweet times, our own old loveliness. And I would like to think that even if at the very beginning of our lives together I had somehow been shown that we would end up here with this longing to be away from each other, this feeling of being trapped together, of being tied to each other in a way that makes us wish for other times, some other place, I would have known enough to accept it all freely for the chance at that love. And if I could, I would do it all again, Marie. All of it. Even the sorrow. My sweet, my dear adversary, for everything that I remember.
Richard Bausch's story, Letter to the Lady of the House, is in his book Selected Stories from Richard Bausch. That's from the Modern Library. His newest book is Thanksgiving Night.
All your love. moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 22-year-old female, and I've been in a relationship for about a year. The guy I'm dating, he's 24, and he says he loves me, but he's not in love with me. I'd asked him before about it. I told him I loved him, and I've asked him several times, and each time I kind of break down, and I worry about it, and he says he loves me, and he says he's not in love with me, or sometimes he says that he thinks he is, but he's not sure. This is my third serious relationship, and he has only had one before me, and it lasted 8 months, and he says he was in love with her, but he didn't actually know that until they had broken up once before, and then when they got back together, he said that he knew that he was in love with her. So he says it is a possibility that he's in love with me, but he doesn't know it. I'm just wondering where I should go from here, because I worry about it. I worry that it's never going to happen, and is a year too long? Should he be in love with me by now? I know it's different for everybody, but is there some sort of time limit on that? He's asked me to move in with him a couple times, but I've told him that I can't because of that one thing that's lacking there. Why would I move in with someone who's not in love with me when that's just going to kind of be a deal breaker in the end?
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better.
So if your pathetic, bullshit boyfriend realized he was in love with his last girlfriend after she dumped his ass enough before, clearly your course of action is to dump his ass. You gotta see this for what it is. He's emotionally stunted, perhaps, has a problem with intimacy, has a bullshit, cliche, tiresome, done-to-death male fear of intimacy thing going on, and you shouldn't hang out, and you shouldn't suffer at the hands of it. It is kind of emotionally cruel of him to keep you dancing around as he hems and haws about whether he loves you or is in love with you and he's not sure. You know what? If you're incapable of reading your own heart, if you're incapable of determining whether or not you're in love with someone, you shouldn't be with anyone. period. You know or you don't know. And there's a certain point, and a lot of straight guys seem to have a problem with this, there's a certain point at which you decide to be in love, where you make, what do they call that fucking thing again? A commitment, where you round it up to in love, even if you have some feelings of ambivalence, even if you have some reservations. Nobody who's in love hasn't had to do that. Hasn't had to round it up, hasn't had to, you know, bungee jump a little bit, hasn't had to decide to overlook what may have been deal breakers once upon a time, or their partner's shortcomings. You suspend your disbelief, you decide that this lovable person is someone that you can commit to being in love with, and you make the fucking commitment. And if you're incapable of making it, you go, you leave, you stop fucking torturing that person. It's cruel to let someone say, I love you, and how do you feel about me, and then to, like, play fucking bullshit straight boy Hamlet games when you can't make it your fucking mind. Dump him. Do not move in with him. And do not hang out. You're 22 years old. You don't need this bullshit. Okay, the sex is great. You really like him. So tell him, you know what? Sex is great. We really like each other. Doesn't get much better than this. I love you. You love me. You're just not sure if you're in love with me. Well, make up your fucking mind or I'm out. All right, I have to apologize for, like, blowing my stack, but I've been writing this stupid sex advice column for 17 years, and I've heard the same story so often from so many women. Never from guys. I never hear from guys who told some woman that they're in love with them or feel like they're in love and are, you know, able to make the commitment and able to verbalize it, who are dating some girl who's, like, hemming and hawing and lying on the fainting couch with her, you know, the back of her hand on her forehead going, I'm not sure, I'm not sure. It pisses me off because I see the emotional fallout from it, and the guys who play this fucking game who think that it makes them more interesting. And sometimes it all makes them Lord Byron or all poets as they fucking torture themselves about whether or not they're in love or just feeling love. Like, fuck off, guys. You make a decision. If you can't, cut her loose. Let her find a guy who has emotional maturity to read his own heart, decide to say he's in love, to see if he's in love. And guys, I have seen this time and time again with guys in my own life, guys that I know, gay guys, straight guys, who play this game of, you know, I love you, but I'm not sure if I'm in love with you, who then are dumped serially by people who rightly don't want to put up with this bullshit all their lives and aren't only going to hang out so long. And time and again, these guys realize after that person who dumped them, that, oh my God, they were in love with them all along. And you know when guys realize this? When that woman or that dude is married to somebody else and it's too late to fucking do anything about it. All right? So stop fucking playing this game, boys. It's bullshit, it's pathetic, it's immature, and it's not getting you anywhere.
Show notes at lies.com. I'm John Callender. Thanks for listening. The Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club.